This time, we would like to dismiss the Sunday school classes. Our teacher this morning is Brother Mac Riley, and the title of his presentation is Psalm 45, Bridegroom and the Bride. Our scripture reading will come from the book of Revelation, chapter 19. Revelation 19, verses 7 to 9. Let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to him. For the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife hath made herself ready. And to her was granted that she should be arrayed as fine linen, clean and white. For the fine linen is the righteousness of saints. And he said unto me, Write, blessed are they which are called unto the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he saith unto me, These are the true sayings of God. I invite your attention to Brother Mac.
My dear brothers and sisters in Christ Jesus our Lord, good morning.
Good morning.
I haven't been this nervous in a long time. Little butterflies this morning. So, we've been going through in the Bonnier Ecclesia the Songs of Solomon. And I've gone through the first eight songs. And I thought that Psalm 45 would just be a nice little something for the Bonnier brethren to throw in at this point in time and be very exhortive. For all of us. It's just such a beautiful psalm. And particularly young people, it's very important that you realize that Psalm 45 is a companion to Song of Solomon. They're meant to be understood together. They really do complement one another just so very well. As I go through this, I Bible marked Psalm 45 and thought this is going to be very easy to do in two classes. I'll talk about the groom in one and the bride in the next, and it'll probably be just about right. And when I looked at how much I'd Bible marked, I said, well, this isn't going to work. It's just way too much. So I'm recording the slideshow because I'm going to have so many verses on the overhead I can't read. And it may be too hard for you to mark down. So just to let you know, I'll have the slideshow recorded. I'll put it up on my website, phanerosis.org, a link to it where you can watch it on Vimeo and you'll see verses if you don't get a chance to write them all down. So let's get started here. When we look at the Psalms and we look at the titles of the Psalms, it's a little bit helpful to have a companion Bible, because Mr. Bullinger puts the superscriptions and the subscriptions in the correct place when that happens. So we're going to talk a little bit about that this morning. But this is a psalm that is prophetical, allegorical. Okay? I personally do not believe, as some Christadelphian writers believe, that either Song of Solomon or Psalm 45 that was intended to be written about any individual. I don't think in Song of Solomon that Solomon was referring to any of his wives, as some Christadelphian writers think. I think this is all allegorical in Psalm 45 as well. In both cases, the intent was to speak about the bride of Christ. So on the idea of being prophetical and allegorical, Let's take a look at just a couple of references here. Isaiah 54, verses 5 through 8. For thy maker is thine husband, Yahweh of hosts is his name, and thy redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, the God of the whole earth, shall he be called. For Yahweh hath called thee as a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit, a wife of youth, when thou wast refused, saith thy God. For a small moment have I forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. In a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment, but with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith Yahweh, thy Redeemer. Now we recognize that that is directly written to the nation of Israel, but I think we see that this is speaking prophetically to them as well. And if it's speaking prophetically to natural Israel, certainly we can include spiritual in there, Israel as well. I'm not going to read the reading from the Apocalypse, since I had Brother Matt open, and I've got this reference in several times, but we'll just read it one time, Ephesians 5, 25 through 28. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the Ecclesia and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of the water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious Ecclesia, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. So, very important. We understand these concepts very well concerning Christ and the Ecclesia. The model of marriage of man and woman should be an idea, should in the idea point towards that, right? It's a type. All right, a note about the superscription and subscriptions now to Psalm 45. So the next note I have on the overhead refers to the sons of Korah, because you'll note, and let me just put it this way, if you've got a King James Bible, you're going to see the note that says, to the chief musician upon Shoshanim. That belongs with Psalm 44, okay? And those of you that have a Bollinger Companion Bible will show that. But the note that does pertain to Psalm 45 there says, for the sons of Korah, Maskil, a song of loves. So, interesting that this beautiful song here is written to the sons of Korah. And why is it that a song about the bride and the bridegroom would be written to the sons of Korah? You know, what a history the sons of Korah had, right? We know Korah himself was destroyed in the rebellion. But I think there's some wonderful lessons we're going to get out of here. And I'm going to give credit to Brother Matt Bennett for the thoughts that I'm going to go through here, because he gave a couple of talks on Zelophehad and his daughters that really just kind of pushed me down this path. We know that not all of the descendants of Korah died in the rebellion. I'm not going to read the references in 26 of Numbers and 27 of Numbers. 26:11 says not all the sons of Korah died. And then chapter 27, we have there the daughters of Zelophehad who come and say, you know, look, our father died in the wilderness and didn't perish after, you know, the sin of Korah. And what are we going to do for an inheritance? We have no husbands. We have no inheritance, you know? And they were given an inheritance. And I think that's going to be just something that's going to be a really interesting thought to think about. This is written to the sons of Korah. And where did they come from? They came from a seed that was traced through the woman, not through the man. That husbands were provided for them to raise up seed to the sons of Korah. Now, when we think of it that way, I think that becomes a very beautiful thing to think about in the relationship to Psalm 45. When we think about Christ and his bride, and particularly where the scriptures say to us in Psalm 22 and in Isaiah 53:10 prophetically that Christ was going to have a seed raised up. Is this seed raised up to him according to the flesh? No, according to the Spirit. And I think that's an interesting point to think about. Now, I also think it's interesting to note that And I'm going to say it right this time, Joseph. In every talk I've given on Song of Solomon, I keep saying Tizra. Tirzah. Tirzah is one of the daughters of Zelophehad. And she's mentioned in Song of Solomon, I believe. Now, I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect that she was either the eldest daughter of Zelophehad. If you look at the names of the daughters as they're listed, they're listed in different orders. Or maybe she was the spokesperson for the group. Maybe she was the lead. And I think when we get to Song of Solomon, and we look at chapter 6 and verse 4 there, I think that she is referred to, and I think it's going to also help us in our study here. So, Song of Solomon chapter 6 in verse 4, this begins the third part of the seventh song. And we read here, concerning the bride, all right, the perfected bride of Christ, thou art beautiful, O my love, as Tirzah, comely as Jerusalem, terrible as an army with banners, or as Brother Ask renders that, instead of terrible as armies with banners, he says dazzling in majestic glory. And that he feels the Hebrew sense there is not really about an army, but about majestic glory. And for any of you who want to study Song of Solomon, get a hold of Brother Ask book, A-S-K. It's really wonderful. I'll be honest with you, I have found that amongst the three resources I have on Song of Solomon, I haven't completely agreed with any of them, but I've used all of them to arrive at, you know, my own personal conclusions. It's a difficult book as you study through it. Well, many of our Christadelphian writers will look at this verse here and think Tirzah is a reference to the city of Tirzah. However, one brother, I listened to a talk from Australia, G. Wigzell, I don't know what his first name is, Brother Wigzell, mentioned that the only city that the bride can be compared to is Jerusalem, and therefore Tirzah must be a proper name here. And isn't it, if that's the case, if that's right, and I can't be dogmatic on this point, brethren, if that's the case, she must have been a wonderful individual. And her concern to raise up a seed after the name of her fathers, a godly seed, and to receive an inheritance in the land is remembered here. All right, let's look at the subscription that we have here. Now, those of you with a King James Oxford edition, at the close of Psalm 45, you don't see anything written there. When you look at the under Psalm 46, we have a phrase that says there, to the chief musician for the sons of Korah, a song upon Alamoth. That belongs with Psalm 45. That's where the companion Bible is very helpful. One day I'm going to go through my Bible and highlight the way all of those should be, because it's not consistent where all of the titles should be moved. You have to look at it. Well, this phrase upon Alamoth is really interesting. It says it's a song upon Alamoth, which Alamoth means concerning virgins. It's a song concerning virgins. I think that's a direct reference to Tirzah and possibly her sisters, in a way, to think about this prophetically, right? When we think about the bride and the bridegroom. I want to flip through just a couple of references in Song of Solomon. There's a lot that I could look at here, but chapter 1 and verse 3, and once again, getting the speakers in Song of Solomon is really difficult. Not every Bible that tries to separate them by speakers may be accurate. Rotherham does a decent job. Brother Mansfield and Brother Ass do good jobs. None of them all agree on who the speaker is, but everybody sort of agrees that in verse 3 that we have the virgins speaking to the bride here. And it says, because the savor of thy good ointments of thy name speaking to the bride is an ointment poured forth, therefore do the virgins love thee. You know, the virgins love the bride. And they are, I would suggest to you, the individual constituents that will one day make up the perfective bride. Prayerfully, all of us in this room constitute those virgins who love the bride as they would love the bridegroom and want to become part of that bride. Chapter 6 and verse 8. And this, I will tell you that chapter 6, verse 8, really difficult verse. None of the commentators necessarily agree in where I ended up on this. I didn't agree with what the Green Book says about it. But there we have here, in what I think is a time period that we might equate with the coronation ceremony. I think Brother John used the phrase yesterday, visions of the throne room. And I think there's going to be a coronation ceremony. And I think that verse 8 kind of refers to this a little bit. There are therefore, there are 80 queens, 80 concubines, and virgins without number. Well, that virgins without number should be the really important clue to us. Now, some Christadelphian writers will look at that virgins as differently than being the individual constituents of the bride. So you'll have to look at all that yourself. Well, then finally, this song is a song of loves, right? A song of love. We think about the Hebrew here. The Hebrew is Yadid, which is a form of Solomon's name that was given to him, Jedidiah, Yadid, a song of love. And we can think about the great love that God has had for both his people and for the bride. And I can already see for the sake of time that I'm going to move on to the next slide and not necessarily read some of the verses that I have on that. That's a concept that we're well aware of. So let's get into verse 1. My heart is inditing a good matter. I speak of the things which I have made touching the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer. Mr. Rotherham renders the first part of this verse, overflowed hath my heart, with an excellent theme. And this is an excellent theme, all right? I think his translation really helps us, and the King James is there too. It helps us point our minds forward that this is going to be the most joyful and wonderful marriage that has ever taken place. Let's look at that reference in Isaiah 66, verse 10, and then verse 14. Isaiah 66 speaks of the great rejoicing that will be had this time. Rejoice ye with Jerusalem, and be glad with her, all ye that love her. Rejoice for joy with her, all ye that mourn for her. And then verse 14. And when ye see this, your heart shall rejoice, and your bones shall flourish like an herb. And the hand of Yahweh shall be known toward his servants, and his indignation toward his enemies. It's going to be such a joyful occasion and such a wonderful occasion. And the writer here is expressing here, you know, that great joy as this vision is seen before him. All right? My heart is inditing a good matter, touching the king. And the king here is the king of the Song of Solomon. It's Christ. It's pointing us forward to that king. We might, you know, think allegorically of David and that type of there as well. I mean, we may think that, and that would not be wrong. But it's the king that we see in Song of Solomon. Let's look at chapter 1 and verse 2 of Song of Solomon. Chapter 1 and verse 12. All right? And this verse, I believe, would be the bride speaking about her love for the king. While the king sitteth at his table, my spikenard sendeth forth the smell thereof. And isn't that beautiful there that the bride wants to put forth such a sweet savor for her groom? And that is what we are endeavoring to do, isn't it? Let's look also at that reference in Isaiah 32, 1 through 4. Behold, a king shall reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment. And a man shall be as an hiding place from the wind, and a covert from the tempest, as the rivers of waters in a dry place, as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. You know, that's speaking of great comfort and being realized as well. And when this king appears, there's going to be that great comfort. And I'm going to hopefully have time to speak about that a little bit more when we get into the bride and her desire to be on the right hand of the groom and to be held by that right hand. All right, the word for ready in this first verse, mahir, means to be diligent, eager, hasty. And it does have the idea of eager to sing in the Hebrew. And of course, this is a song, so that's very important. It's an adjective also that indicates great skill and well-versed. It's the same type of an idea that we would see in Daniel 12:3, and I think when we read there of the wise who will shine forth as the brightness of the firmament, the skilled, the wise. All right, the second verse. Thou art fairer. This is speaking of that king of chapter 1, that groom. Thou art fairer than the children of men. Grace is poured into thy lips. Therefore God hath blessed thee forever. The Hebrew word for fairer here, yapah, has the idea of being bright, to be excellent. And most of the commentators on the Hebrew language here will also say that this word has an idea to be bright, to be fair in a moral, excellent character, ethically. And I think that's kind of an interesting thought there, isn't it? And I think that, you know, we might think about some of the verses that I have here towards the end. I've got the contrast of Isaiah 53:2 there. What does Isaiah say about the Lord there? That when we shall see him, there's nothing we would desire of him. But ethically, morally, he was beautiful, right? And the disciples saw that. He was fairer than the children of men. But also, I think it's certainly appropriate to think about how beautiful he will be seen when he comes in his glory as well. Possibly that phrase of Isaiah 53:2 will no longer apply there. In Song of Solomon chapter 5, verses 10 through 16, I really enjoyed going through this study in Bon Air in this chapter. We've got there recalled by the bride how beautiful and how fair the groom is there. So in verse 10 through 16, it is the bride speaking, and I want to read those. And if you go through here, you're going to notice that there are 10 qualities that are described about the groom. In the vernacular of the day, we might say he was a perfect 10. And perhaps maybe that silly rating system might have come from somebody who realized there's 10 qualities here of the groom, and it just becomes something applied in the world in a way that is nowhere near as meaningful as it should have been. My beloved is white and ruddy, the chiefest among 10,000s, and that 10,000s would relate us to the saints. And then look at these characteristics. His head is as the most fine gold, his locks as bushy and black as the raven. His eyes are as the eyes of doves by the rivers of waters, washed with milk and fitly set. His cheeks are as a bed of spices, as sweet flowers. His lips like lilies, dropping sweet-smelling myrrh. His hands are as gold rings set with beryl. His belly is as bright ivory overlaid with sapphire. His legs are as pillars of marble set upon sockets of fine gold. His countenance is as Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet, yea, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. And as I read through that, hopefully, you know, all our minds would go to some of the symbolic things that we could pick out here on your end, because certainly I don't have time to go through all of that this morning. That is a talk in and of itself. But some beautiful things that are said there typically, and I think it helps us to maybe even think about Hebrews chapter 1 there and the beautiful things that we see there. He was ethically and morally beautiful. He was fairer than the children of men. In Hebrews chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, which I can't seem to come up on the... Just trying to save some time by pulling some of this stuff up on my iPad. I probably could have turned it up faster. Here we go. It didn't want to work right anyway. Speaking of Christ, who being the brightness of his glory, the express image of his person, in upholding all things by the word of his power, when he had by himself purged sin, sat down on the right hand of the majesty on high, being made so much better than the angels, as he hath by inheritance obtained a more excellent name than they. You know, particularly when we see those terms being the brightness of his glory, the express image of his person, the Greek word for the image there is character, which means an exact engraving. He was the moral example of his heavenly Father and was fairer than the children of men. Now, I want to get through this, so there's going to be a lot of summarization here, and I'm going to hope you're going to follow my thoughts here, because I wanted to read Psalm 8, but I just don't think I'm going to, but I am going to talk about it. He's fairer than the children of men, and the Hebrew word there is Adam. And so, you know, think about Psalm 8, and don't think about it just as a psalm written about David. Remember that in Hebrews chapter 2, Paul is very emphatic that Psalm 8 is about Christ. All right? And what does that psalm speak of? It points forward to the time of having great dominion, all things being put under subjection to him. Christ was more deserving, in other words, than any of the children of Adam. He's the one that could receive the throne. He's the one that could receive this majesty over the earth. Only he could receive that great dominion. And we know that Psalm 8, we can take that all the way back to Genesis, and we can look at, you know, the creation account and how Adam was placed over the garden, but he didn't live up to that great ideal, but Christ did. And he is that one who is fairer than all the children of Adam. And of course, you know, Philippians chapter 2 speaks about, you know, how his name will be exalted throughout all the earth, and that he was fair in that manner. Grace will come from his lips. He is the median of divine favor, this verse takes us to. We look forward to that time to hear his words of grace, and all of the nations will hear it, will hear these wonderful words that he will speak. Isaiah chapter 50 and verse 4 says, Adonai Yahweh hath given me the tongue of the learned, that I should know how to speak a word in season to him that is weary. He wakeneth morning by morning, he wakeneth mine ear to hear as to learn. Of course, this reference was read earlier this week. You know, and the Lord is going to be capable and is capable even now of speaking such words of grace. And, you know, we look forward to that time where the nations will hear it and they will understand that he is the medium of divine favor. The second verse does close with speaking that therefore God hath blessed thee forever. Now, certainly, is Christ in a great position of blessing now in the right hand of the Father? Yes. But this Hebrew word here, which we're familiar with, most of us hopefully, olam, really points us to a special period. You know, right now, Christ really is only appreciated for what he truly is, the glory he has, the grace he offers by a select few, really, a precious few throughout the brotherhood. But when the promises made to Abraham and David are revealed, you know, that's going to be realized in a much larger audience throughout the inhabitants of the earth. He is of the seed of David. And it's interesting that this phrase olam is used so frequently in reference to the promises made to David. And I was silly to think I was going to have time to read all these references I have on the screen. But let's just look at the one in 2 Samuel. My older Bible, I've got a couple of notes in 2 Samuel that intended to read here, but I'm not going to. The word Olam occurs, now I do need my old Bible. I'll have to look it up later. It's either, I think it's seven times in 2 Samuel 7. It's either seven or eight. Have to go through and look at that, so it's very special. But we see how tied up it is in with the promises made to David here. All right, verse 12. And when thy days be fulfilled, thou shalt sleep with thy fathers. I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build an house for my name. I will establish his throne for the Olam. All right? The Olam is greatly connected with the fulfillment of the promises of David. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my mercy shall not depart away from him, as I took it from Saul, who I put away before thee. And thine house and thy kingdom shall be established for the Olam before thee. Thy throne shall be established for the Olam. Now it's throughout the whole chapter, and I'm pretty sure I'm remembering it right, that it's seven times Olam appears in this chapter. You're going to have to check me on that, make sure that my memory's right. And the other references that I have here, Psalm 18 and Psalm 89, all refer to the promises to David and connecting it with the Olam. So when the writer takes us here in Psalm 45 to this idea that he is fairer, the groom, Christ, fairer than the children of men, grace will pour from his lips, and he has been blessed for the Olam. We should think about a time period when the realization of the promises made to David become a reality. All right, let's talk about this third verse. Gird thy sword upon thy thigh, O most mighty, with thy glory and thy majesty. Now, this might seem a little bit odd for a moment, because I am wanting us to look at Psalm 45 as being pointing forward to the time more of the marriage supper. In its reality, the marriage of the bride and the groom becoming a reality in the nations conquered. And we might think, well, what about this girding up the sword? That sounds like, you know, action for battle. And certainly the sword can be thought of that way. And some of the references that I have here certainly point to it that way, of you know, having gird the sword in battle and going to fight. But now, you know, he's told to gird up thy sword upon thy thigh. There's a similar phrase in Song of Solomon chapter 3 and verse 8 there as well. A similar phrase. And at this point in time, and when we get to chapter 3 and verse 8 of Song of Solomon, and we have this reference here, they all hold swords, being experts in war. Every man hath his sword upon his thigh because of the fear in the night. The speaker here in this verse is the daughter of Zion, not a representative of the ecclesia, but a representative of natural Israel. And they're seeing Christ now, this great entrance into Jerusalem with the saints, and the sword has been finished and being used in battle and is girt upon the thigh. Okay, it's placed on the thigh. It's not needing to be wielded by the hand anymore at that point in time. The battle has been won. And I think that is a little bit of what we're seeing here as we look in this particular verse as well. And that sword is going to be used in a great sense at that point in time in education. Well, excuse me. I took a decongestant this morning. Y'all don't need to do this. Now I'm drinking so much water that I'm getting a little bit of gas in the stomach, but I'm trying not to get dehydrated. All right, Isaiah 49. Too much information. Isaiah 49 in verse 2. Let's just read what's prophetically read about Christ here. And he hath made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of my hand hath he hid me, and made me a polished shaft. In his quiver he hath hid me. You know, the words that Christ will speak It'll be a great time because the nations are going to hear and understand what we've been blessed to understand all along. What a great time. That mouth, that sharp sword, cutting straight, judging in righteousness, judging perfectly, the people hearing and understanding. A beautiful time. Hebrews 4:12, I've got on the overhead, we understand it, a great memory verse. The Word of God is living and energetic, powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword. I think that's the depiction we're seeing here. Christ will have that sword gird upon his thigh. The verse says to us that he is a most mighty warrior with glory and majesty. He will go forth as a representative of Yahweh, and people will know it. I already read from Hebrews 1:3. I'm not going to turn to that again. But I did want to read Psalm 21 at this point in time. It's a short psalm. And the subscript there, I think, is an interesting one. Once again, it's found connected with Psalm 22. We need to know that it needs to belong up with Psalm 21, but that subscript reads to the chief musician, and I know I don't know how to pronounce this right, Aleph Shah, which literally means the day dawn. This is a chapter that I think we might look at as a chapter that relates to that great coronation ceremony. And I believe that. I believe Christ is going to be crowned as King of Kings with all the nations to see it. You know, man has had its coronation ceremonies. England's going to have one soon. It's going to have a lot of pomp and circumstance to it. But nothing will be as meaningful when Christ is proclaimed King of Kings and stands upon this earth. So I'm going to just read the first six verses here in Psalm 21. The king shall joy in thy strength, O Yahweh, and in thy salvation how greatly shall he rejoice. Thou hast given him his heart's desire, and hast not withholden the request of his lips, Selah. For thou preventest him with the blessings of goodness. Thou settest a crown of pure gold on his head. He asked life of thee, and thou gavest it him, even length of days forever and ever. His glory is great in thy salvation. Honor and majesty hast thou laid upon him. For thou hast made him most blessed forever. Thou hast made him exceeding glad with thy countenance. And of course, the rest of the chapter is good too. But I think that points us forward to this time of great glory. A day of coronation, all of the earth will see and understand. Pardon me. All right, the word for majesty in this verse in Psalm 45, the Hebrew hadar, has been translated as comeliness, all right, in Isaiah 53, and as honor in Psalm 8:5. This majesty will be with a great honor. The people today don't honor the Lord in truth and in righteousness, the people of the nations, but that will come to him. And we see that prophetically here in this psalm. All right, I might finish where I want to today on the first class. We got plenty of time. Verse 4. And in thy majesty ride prosperously because of truth and meekness and righteousness. And thy right hand shall teach thee terrible things. You know, I think the King James, every time we see the word terrible show up, it's translated to what the Hebrew word does mean there. But I ended up looking at this word, and it's used in Song of Solomon as well. And I think that Brother asked, you know, maybe onto something. You know, the Hebrew language is something that's, words have multiple meanings to them in Hebrew. You know, there's a lot fewer words in Hebrew than there are in English, and it often, you know, comes across the context, right, as to how it should be translated. you know, the people aren't going to see this writing in majesty at this particular time as a terrible thing, but a majestic thing. And that's one of the references that Brother Ask often gives in Song of Solomon when that word shows up for terrible is majestic. All right, he's going to ride prosperously because of truth and meekness and righteous. Well, the Hebrew word for ride there is rahab, right? We're familiar with that word in our studies on the cherubim. Brother Thomas makes such reference to it. It's the same word, all right? We think about how Brother Thomas talks to us about how the cherub and the word ride in Hebrew, it's just the switching of the letters to get cherub and rahab, that hemantically we switch the letters and we come up with an idea. And therefore, Brother Thomas has always taught us that the idea of the cherub is a vehicle in which the divine majesty rides. And Christ is that vehicle in which the divine majesty has resided to this point in time in such wondrous beauty. Psalm 80 in verse 1 is a verse that speaks of the riding of the cherubim through the heavens, how Yahweh will ride through the cherubim. And so I think that we see that when this groom is manifested in the earth, he will be that representation of the cherubim. And the nations will see it. And I think we have a reference later on, hopefully I'll get to it, and then I won't skip over it, where the bride also is going to be tied in to that cherubim as well. He goes forth for the cause of, as the ESV says here, or for the sake of, as the New English Translation has here, for the sake of truth and meekness and righteousness. Right? So the word because there fits, but I think those other translations are very good as well. He goes forth so that there is going to be justice and meekness and righteousness. And, you know, that's going to affect all of the world, not just the nations, but the brotherhood as well. The saints will be a part of that. So, I just want to think about what Christ said to the Pharisees there. Somehow, I just don't seem to be able to touch on this and bring the verses up today. The Lord said to the Pharisees, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! Ye pay tithe and mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law." King James says judgment, mercy, and faith. Judgment, I think, has the idea of justice there. Justice. You've omitted justice, mercy, and faith. These ought ye have done, and not to have left the other undone. Well, if the Pharisees certainly had a problem with it, we know that the rulers of this world have a bigger problem with it. Right? And we experience it even in the household at times. But Christ is going to go forth on behalf of justice and mercy and faith. I don't have a lot of time to read all these references. How about Isaiah 11, 1 through 5? I think that is probably the best of the references that we have time to turn up because it speaks to this verse. Isaiah 11, start at verse 1. "And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. And the Spirit of Yahweh shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of Yahweh, and shall make him of quick understanding in the fear of Yahweh. And he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears. But with righteousness shall he judge the poor, and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. And righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins." And of course, if we kept reading through Isaiah 11, we certainly see the indications that this is a song in Isaiah 11. I said song, a chapter that is pointing us forward to the kingdom age. Certainly Christ spoke in his ministry with these things, but he will speak it in a manner that all men will hear and bow down to in the kingdom age. I want to be nice when we don't have to listen to men argue about politics. It'll just be his righteous rule. Certainly so. All right, the phrase shall teach at the close of this verse. I do kind of like how the New English Translation renders it there. Accomplish mighty acts. He shall accomplish mighty acts. And let's go back to 2 Samuel chapter 7 and read that reference that we have here on the overhead. 2 Samuel 7 in verse 23. In what one nation in the earth is like thy people, even like Israel, whom God went to redeem from a people to himself and to make him a name and to do for you great things and terrible, majestic. And for thy land before thy people, which thou redeemest to thee from Egypt, from the nations and their gods. Well, when we think about what Israel will become in the kingdom age, there will certainly be mighty acts accomplished when Israel becomes the first dominion of the kingdom. Let's go on to verse 5. Thine arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies, whereby the people fall unto thee. All right. So, I think we could look at this verse as either being, you know, representative of the battles that have been fought, or I think it can be representative as well as the accomplishment of really subjugating the nations by the words of truth. Okay? And we could look at the arrows as either being those literal arrows of Zechariah 9, verses 13 and 14. What does that verse say? It speaks of Ephraim going forth, right, in that mighty fashion. You know, the arrow of the Lord to fight. In order to teach the world justice, there's going to have to be that battle, that warfare, right? That is going to have to come to pass. I'm summarizing a little bit more than I intended to because I'm watching the time. You know, but we also, I think, should think about what I read just a few minutes ago from Isaiah 49:2 when it talked about, you know, Christ going forth with that sword of truth, the arrows that are in his quiver, in the idea of teaching that is expressed there. A lot of effort will go forth. A lot of effort will go forth in not just fighting and overcoming the nations, but then striking them in the heart, whereby the people will become subjugated underneath Christ. These arrows will hit in the heart. And what is the heart? It's the seat of thought, right? We've got some great verses on the overhead that I'm not going to have time to turn to, but you know, you can think of them. Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is desperately wicked. It needs to be pierced through with the arrow of truth, doesn't it? Hopefully that's happening for all of us in our lifetime from our baptism and forward and from being children in the truth and learning the truth. We know what the Lord said in Matthew chapter 12, out of the heart proceedeth those things which corrupt a man, which defile a man. The heart needs to be subjugated. The heart of flesh needs to be slain. We even think of what Ezekiel writes about natural Israel, right? What is going to happen to their heart? That heart of stone is going to be replaced, right? With that heart that will be subjugated to the people, they will learn. So as I'm deciding what I'm going to read and what I'm not going to read, I decided I wasn't going to read Psalm 22:27 originally, but now I'm like, well, no, I think that's the appropriate place to end this thought. Let's go to that real quick. Psalm 22:27. All the ends of the world shall remember and turn unto Yahweh, and all the kindreds of the nation shall worship before thee. They're going to do so because they've been struck through the heart with that arrow of truth. Yes, they're going to experience the sword, but what is left is going to be completely humbled before God. And I think that's where we look at this last phrase here in the verse. The people shall fall under thee. The word that is there has the idea in Hebrew of subjugation. And I think we could see that realization of the prophecy that we have then of Judah in Genesis 49. And I'm going to read that for us. Genesis 49. And I'm just going to read the 10th verse. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. And notice I'm going to read this next word differently. For Shiloh shall come, and unto him shall the gathering of the peoples be, or the subjugation of the peoples be. That's how Brother Thomas renders that in an article that I found years ago in the Herald of the Kingdom of Age to Come. For Shiloh shall come, and unto him shall the subjugation of the peoples be. That's how he's going to gather them together. You know, when Christ has that scepter and it won't depart, the saints are already with him ruling in righteousness. So who are the people referred to? And I think even Brother Mansfield in the Green Book on the Expositor does a really good job on this verse and says the people here that are subjugated, this is referring to the nations. And I think we see a little bit that here in Psalm 45 as well. I'll take that as a note for another sip of water. All right. Doing good on time, but I still think I might run just a tad bit over. We'll see where we end up here. Let's go on to verse 6. Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of thy kingdom is a right scepter. All right. We need to understand that when it says thy throne, O God, we're referring to the throne of David. Christ will sit upon this throne, but it's perfectly appropriate for it to be called the throne of God, even though it will be Christ sitting upon that throne as the manifestation of his Father, right? Christ is both the Son of God. We see that in Hebrews 1:8-9, and I do want to read those verses because those promises that are listed in Hebrews are so important. We recently went through this in our Bon Air Sunday School class, too. But we have written here of Christ prophetically, and Paul is going to be quoting here from Psalm 45. All right? So here's Paul's usage of the verse that I'm now reading in Psalm 45. And Paul says, but unto the Son he saith, thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of thy kingdom. Thou hast loved righteousness and hated iniquity. Therefore God, even thy God, hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. Well, you can see how Paul uses this verse here where Psalm 45 says, thy throne, O God. And Paul says here, did I just say that right? Psalm 45, I didn't say Paul wrote Psalm 45, did he? Did I? I misspeak so much, sometimes I even think I might have. Okay, but you see how Paul quotes here in Hebrews that psalm and shows us that Christ is that representation of the Almighty when it says, thy throne, O God. It is Christ's throne. He will rule here. He is the Son that would be born of David that was promised in 2 Samuel chapter 7. He's going to be that realization of what Jeremiah chapter 23 and verse 5 and 6 has to say as well. And what a great prophecy that we have there. And I do want to try to read that real quick. Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and a king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth. In his days Judah shall be saved, and Israel shall dwell safely. And this is his name, whereby he shall be called Yahweh, our righteousness. Christ will be that full manifestation of God upon the earth, and the nations will know, they will listen to him, and that throne will be for the Olam. It will be a right scepter, all right, ruling in justice. The references that I have on the board, look at them later, Jeremiah 33, 15 and 16, Psalm 72. I could have put Isaiah 11 in again at this particular point of being a right scepter, one that is full of justice. All right. 10:28, I'm probably going to run over by just a few minutes if you will allow me, but I want to try to get through verse 8 here. All right, verse 7. Thou lovest righteousness and hatest wickedness. Therefore God thy God hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. And once again, Paul quoted this verse. This verse shows us that the Trinitarians trying to use the previous verse to teach the Trinity just isn't true, because verse 8 then says, the God thy God hath anointed thee, right? Speaking of Christ. So this verse helps us to disprove that idea. All right. Very important to understand that love is a very important concept, isn't it? But so is hate, when it's applied correctly with as a divine quality, right? To hate wickedness is something that is important. A righteous mind can practice this of hating wickedness as need be. Let's look at Psalm 5:5. Probably takes a lifetime to hit this point. And maybe some of us never really get rid of the unrighteous hatred and only possess the righteous hatred, but this verse is very good. The foolish shall not stand in thy sight. Thou hatest all workers of iniquity. And remember what the ecclesia in Ephesus was praised for. They were praised because they hated the doctrines of the Nicolaitans. So, very important quality that is manifested by the king here. He's going to sit upon this throne for the Olam and manifest this right scepter because he loved righteousness throughout his life and he hated wickedness. He overcame sin. He always kept it in subjection. And he only looked forward to those things that produce glory to God. I think in this verse we have another reference in the way Paul used it as well. And I know we kind of mentioned it. I think Brother David had Sunday school class at that point in time. I might be confusing my thoughts. But I think this is just another one of those interesting verses here that might point us forward to an enthronement ceremony that takes place in the kingdom age when we get to this point in time. Is not Christ already been anointed by the Heavenly Father? Certainly, he has. Anointed with the Spirit, anointed with glory and honor. But this verse speaks of a time where he hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. His gladness is only going to be fully accomplished when he has that bride, when he has his fellows with him. So I think there is an indication here of an enthronement ceremony. Brother John took us to Revelation 5 yesterday as that idea. He talked about it, the throne room. I think that could be an indication there in Revelation chapter 5 if we look at it closely, when the angels stand forth and shout for glory. Why? Because the realization of someone sitting upon David's throne has come to pass. That crown has been put upon his head at this point in time. He will be anointed with oil of gladness. The marriage will be over. It will be complete. It will be a time of wonderful happiness. And the verse says, he will be anointed with gladness above thy fellows. Why is the word fellows used here? Because there will be those with him that experience that joy. Associate kings and priests. as we do read in Revelation 5, 9, and 10. What does it say there? What is the shout for glory? Thou hast made us kings and priests, and we will reign forever along with our master at that point in time. I do want to look at Psalm of Solomon one more time here. It's 10:33. I'm going to try to get through verse 8 quickly, and then we'll take a break. But I want to look at chapter 6, verse 10, before I close. All right, I'm going to suggest to you that this 10th verse here is a verse that is going to be spoken by the subjugated nations. All right, some of the Christadelphian writers that you might look at don't agree with what I'm going to say here, so study that on your own and come to your own conclusion, because I'll tell you, as I go through Song of Solomon, it's been really humbling how hard it is sometimes to come to conclusions, because there's a variety of thought even in the Brotherhood. It's a difficult book. But I like looking at this particular verse this way. Here's the nations, they're looking at this enthronement ceremony, and they're seeing the bride along with the bridegroom. Who is she that looketh forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun? And as Brother Ask would render this, majestic as the stars in procession. That's how Brother Ask translates that particular verse. Majestic as the stars in profession. You know, the first time the nations have that realization and see all of this put together, that's the exclamation that takes place here. I hope I'm not going too fast through this. I probably bit off more than I can chew, but that's the story of my life when it comes to subjects. Verse 8. All thy garments smell of myrrh, aloes, cassia out of the ivory palaces whereby they have made thee glad. All right. Why are some of these things important? What does myrrh relate to? It means bitter. All right. It's the fragrance of the king, if you will. All right. It was one of the gifts that was brought to Christ by those wise men who had traveled from afar. In John 19, verse 39, it was with him in his death when Nicodemus comes to get the body of the Lord. It is anointed with myrrh at his death. It was part of the anointing oil of Exodus chapter 30 and verse 23. Interestingly about that anointing oil in Exodus, we may have some of the ingredients, but there's never any instructions getting how to make it. It was a secret thing, known only to those who are wise, if you will. A very secret thing. It's interesting that it's used as a beauty treatment in Esther, isn't it? In Proverbs 7:17. You know, we think of his death, we think of that crucifixion and that myrrh, and it is, if you will, to us a great beauty treatment, isn't it? Song of Solomon chapter 1 and verse 13 has what I think is an extremely beautiful comment, and this is the bride here speaking of her love for the beloved of Christ. And she says, a bundle of myrrh is my well-beloved unto me. Brother Ask would render this verse, it shall lie all the night between my breasts, speaking of that bundle of myrrh. It's not he, but it shall lie. Because at this point in time, in our study of the Song of Solomon, the bride still hasn't been perfected. She still hasn't seen her groom. She's desiring his coming. But all the night long, between her breasts lies that bundle of myrrh next to her heart. Always in remembrance. Always in remembrance of her king. So the myrrh is just such a beautiful thing that we see here in this 8th verse. All of the garments of this groom, they smell of myrrh and aloes and cassia. All right, aloes. I didn't read that. Hopefully you read it. When we think about the myrrh, it comes from the bark of a tree, relating to the sacrifice, right? We see that bark of the tree. aloes, ahialim, and I know I didn't pronounce that correctly, to clear, to be clear, to shine, to be bright. It's obtained from the inner wood of a tree. You know, it's hard to get at a character and really change it, isn't it? To really get down to the bones and the marrow, as Hebrews 4:12 says. But when we think of how Christ is anointed with this aloe, his character was perfect to the joints and the marrow, if you will, to the inner wood. It was there. That character was self-evident. In Song of Solomon chapter 4 and verse 14, I think aloe there is used as a symbol of temperance and self-control. And Christ practices that. It's a wonderful compound because it can heal wounds and burns, and we all need healing. Do we not? And he is able to provide that and has provided the basis for it. He has provided that healing. The verse says, out of ivory palaces whereby they have made thee glad. In many Bibles, this begins a new thought. All right? So his garments smell of myrrh, aloes, and acacia. And then we have this new thought. Out of the ivory palaces whereby they have made thee glad. Ivory is to denote royalty. Okay? It was the gifts of kings. The gifts of kings to the kings of Israel. The word whereby at the close of this verse comes from the Hebrew word men. And it comes from an unused word which means a musical chord. All right? A musical chord. So some of our more modern translations here will recognize that. And when we read it in some of those references, we will pick that up. And it'll say something like, out of the ivory palaces, the music of joyfulness comes forth. Out of this coronation ceremony, if you will. All right. I wanted to go 5 minutes over. I went 10 minutes over. I'm going to try not to do that in our next class. Let's take our break right here.